Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back Laurel Sisler as our guest co-host today. Welcome back, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to have an exciting show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Blythe Corbett, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Vanderbilt University and director of the SENSE program for autism, and one of the graduates of the program, Shekiah Webster. This sounds like an amazing potential program that they are doing research on. How exciting is that?
Yeah, using theater to impact the lives of kids.
First, though, we have some impressive research. And our very first one is, if parents give their kids alcohol when they're teens, does that introduce them? Like, we don't want our child to go to college and never have tried alcohol, so we're going to give them some as a teen.
Yeah, it's a myth that's out there, and this, or at least this study, is pointing towards it being a myth and not really based in fact.
Your parents didn't give you alcohol, said, here, Laurel, we want to stop this.
They did not.
My parents didn't either. But the real question in this study is, would it have been worse? And this research suggests it may have been.
Right, yeah. So a six-year study of almost 2,000 teenagers and their parents, and looking at parents who did provide alcohol for their teenagers versus those who did not, and they got it primarily from other sources, and showed that generally problems related to alcohol were lower in the group that had to go to other places and couldn't get it from their parents.
Yeah, I found this really quite remarkable because there were significant differences here. And we do know as the kids got older, they were more likely to get alcohol from their parents. And that was from 15% when they were probably starting the study at age 13, and by the time of 18, there was 57%. And the proportion who had no access to alcohol went down from 81% to 21%. Well, that's how we might expect. But what they then looked at the end of the study is how many had things like binge drinking, the things that are more likely to cause serious, significant adverse problems for these youth. Mm-hmm. And it was much higher in those who accessed alcohol through the parents and others compared to those who accessed it through others only, compared to then those who were alcohol by their parents, compared to those who weren't given alcohol by their parents. So there was kind of a gradation here that suggests that is a myth, that if you give your kids alcohol, you insulate them in any form or fashion. Not true.
Right. My next question, which I'll have to look up because it's not in this particular study, is does it differ by country too? Because there are a lot of cultural norms and things that go into that. But
yeah, this was done in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't apply here in the United States, and certainly not your home
My homeland of Canada. Your
homeland of Canada. Yes, right. We're insulated. I don't think so.
I'm so different from those Australians.
Let's talk about an interesting next research that matters, and this has to do with breast cancer. And we've talked on this show about the links with obesity, with multiple types of cancer. And this is about obesity and breast cancer, but it's not the way you think about it normally. What's up?
Yeah, so looking at women who – so BMI is that measure of technically who fits in that obese category versus, you know, overweight or normal weight.
The body mass index.
Right,
okay.
Right. And so they're looking at people with a quote-unquote normal BMI, meaning that they're in that normal weight for their height.
So they're not overweight.
Not overweight. Not obese. Right.
But even within that range,
yeah,
a body mass index of 20 to 25 – that might be a 10 or 15 pound difference from the bottom of that range to the top of that range.
Right.
All would be normal weight, but some weigh more than others.
Yeah, some weigh more than others. And what we're really starting to understand in this article is in line with that, is that it's where you carry your fat that matters most. And so they're looking at women with higher fat percentage, and that really is predictive of breast cancer, even when their BMI is normal, quote unquote normal.
And this was research that was part of the Women's Health Initiative, and it was presented at the American Association for Cancer Research. And you know, over 3,400 participants, and then seeing those that came up with cancer, and that for each 5 kilogram increase in whole body fat, even among those with a normal body mass index, there was higher levels of cancer. And also physical activity was lower in these women with higher amount of body fat. So I think there's more to the story, but clearly excess body fat itself, because these tumors, most of them were sensitive to estrogen, which is related to body fat.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why in our weight management program at UNC Family Medicine, we look at waist circumference and not just BMI. So that tends to be a more accurate measure of overall health risk in addition to BMI.
And physical activity can reduce body fat.
Right.
Ah.
Yes.
The secret sauce. Let's talk about the secret sauce of our children and how to ensure that their sleep is appropriate. Also because inappropriate sleep among children is linked to obesity in children. And we know childhood obesity is a strong predictor of adult obesity.
Yeah, right. So it doesn't just make you crazy when your toddler is up all night, but it also might be bad for their health long term.
It does make me crazy. It did, at least. But the real question here is, you know, what's going on here? Because we know that there's so many more stimuli that children have. They have their phones, they're looking on their phones, they're on their iPads, maybe TV, radio, you know, all the stimulations. And so it's not just the duration of sleep that these researchers found, it was the quality of the sleep. And so those interruptions then were also equally damaging.
Yeah, you think about all the important things that happen in terms of weight regulation when you're sleeping and when you're having good quality long sleep periods. That's what seems to be getting interrupted here and causing weight gain in children.
Yeah, this was research that came out of Virginia Commonwealth University, 120 children who are part of a longitudinal study, and they had all kinds of measures. It's good research.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that causally related, but it certainly suggests this makes sense.
Right.
Speaking of making sense, our last research that matters is one that I know makes sense to you, and it makes sense to me, and we think it's really quite important, and maybe listeners have heard, but it's the relationship between even a single cigarette a day and the risk of cancer, heart attacks, strokes, those sorts of things.
Yeah, just the risk is incredibly high. You know, I was just talking to about 100 first-year medical students this morning doing a training on helping people fight tobacco addiction and how their role as medical students and future physicians. And one of the questions that two people asked me afterwards was, I still have friends who smoke on the weekends only, or I still have friends who smoke occasionally, and how bad is that? And this study is another one that highlights really how even very low levels of smoking, just one cigarette per day, significantly increases your cardiovascular risk.
Yeah, they did a comprehensive review of the evidence. This was in the British Medical Journal today. And they found that men who smoked one cigarette per day had a 40% of the risk of the heart disease of those who would smoke 20 cigarettes a day, and 41% of the stroke risk of those who smoked 20 cigarettes a day. You would think it would be like
1%.
You know, only 5%.
Or 5%,
you know, but it wasn't. And women had 31% of the risk of heart disease and 34% of the stroke. And this is just a cigarette a day. And so it also lets me realize that, you know, those who are using e-cigarettes, which, you know, but yet they continue to have a couple cigarettes a day, their risk is not nearly the level that they think it is.
Right.
It's still significantly high. The goal is really abstinence. It really is quitting.
Right. Yeah. And a report on e-cigarettes came out last week talking about complete substitution from e-cigarettes to, from conventional cigarettes to e-cigarettes, reducing harm significantly. But I think the key word there is that complete substitution. And you don't find that very often. At least I don't in clinical practice.
Yeah. We got a lot of work to do, but we're going to take a short break, and we're going to do the work of listening to some amazing guests. We're going to be listening to Dr. Blythe Corbett and Shekiah Webster, doctor and patient who are committed to the Sense Theater program for children with autism spectrum disorders. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Today on Conversations, Laurel, we're talking about the Sense Theater Program for children and youth with autism spectrum disorders with an expert, Dr. Blythe Corbett, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Vanderbilt and director of the program, and Shekiah Webster, a former participant. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Corbett and Shekiah.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you too.
We are so excited to have you both on the phone. And I must say, this is really, I think, one of the first for Your Health that we're really so excited to really engage with someone who's participating and benefiting from a program that's so promising that we're talking about. So it's really exciting to have you both on the program.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
And I know we always like to start out and want to just know a little bit about the people we're talking with. Maybe, Dr. Corbett, start out and tell us just a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in psychiatry and behavioral sciences and research on autism. And then we'll ask Shekiah to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sounds great. So I'm an associate professor at Vanderbilt University in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and I'm also the director of the Sense Lab. And what we're really interested in the Sense Lab is really better understanding social and emotional functioning of children and youth with autism spectrum disorder. I've had a long-standing interest, both personally and professionally, in theater. And so several years ago, I really got the idea that this might be an optimal intervention for working with children with autism to address some of the core challenges that they have in social communication.
And Shekiah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I'm from Aiken Elementary School from Nashville, Tennessee. It's almost next to Vanderbilt. I'm in fourth grade now, and it's getting hard for me a lot. And I was in the Sense Theater when I was 6 years old, and I was part of the makeover.
The play that we did and that I wrote for the children is called The Makeover.
Dr. Corbett, while we're still focused on your background a little bit, I have to ask, is there a particular story? You talked about personal experience with theater and this idea with treating autism. Help me connect the dots a little bit more.
Yeah, so I was a professional actor and writer for many years before I actually went to college and decided to go into clinical psychology. And the theater was truly transformative for my life. And so I thought of it always as something that could be pivotal in helping change others who had challenges with relating with others or had anxiety in social situations or just needed some help thinking more flexibly about how we look at the world.
And I wonder, Shekiah, how did you meet Dr. Corbett and hear about this Sense program?
I met her maybe a long time, and then she said, can you please do something with me? Can you please do a play for me, please? And I just said, yes, I will do that for you. And she just cheered, and then that's how I get into the program.
I think that you had some special abilities, which were, you were, sounds like, very enthusiastic.
Yes, I am.
Did you know what this whole program was about, or did you just say this was something that could be fun?
I know the program was it all about. It was good for me because I really have autism. And I have full awareness about myself and my conscious mind.
That sounds really amazing. And I guess one follow-up question is, Dr. Corbett, how did you really come up with this idea? I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, we could create a theater program for those facing the difficulties of autism-related medical conditions, but how did you really think that that was going to be something really revolutionary, which it is?
Well, thank you for saying so. So being a clinical researcher, I was hopeful that this would be a promising intervention, but we wanted to test it as well. And so we started out with a very small pilot project back in 2009 and kicked it off that way. And we measured many different aspects of functioning to see if things changed, what exactly changed. And so that was our very first pilot project. And we started out small, and then we expanded and got one grant and then another. And currently our work is actually funded by the National Institute of Mental Health.
I'm curious, wondering about the specific techniques you use. And Dr. Corbett, you could talk about it a little bit, and then I would love to hear from Shakaya's perspective what it looks like, a day-to-day experience in the Sense Theater.
Sure. We utilize a number of theater techniques, such as creating a character and role-playing. And we also use different theater games to include improvisation. We implement this through 10 different sessions. And one of the really important ingredients as part of our program is we include typically developing trained peers who are actually young actors. And they are paired one-on-one with each of our participants, like Shakaya. And so they serve as kind of an expert role model on some of the very skills that we want our children to learn.
Wow. So there's this peer support aspect. There is a 10-week, it sounds like a little bit of a curriculum, some performances. How long do people typically participate?
So it's 10 sessions. It's roughly a 40-hour intervention. And so each of our sessions are roughly about 3.5 hours. They take place on Saturdays, so we don't want to interfere with the school functioning for the kids, and it's easier on the families. And then after those sessions, we have usually 2 public performances that we do, right? Remember?
And so, Shakaya, you come in, you get introduced to Dr. Corbett, you hear about this theater she's doing, and you say, I'd like to do that. That sounds pretty bold on your part. Where did you get the courage to say that's something that you would like to do, knowing that it might be different and maybe difficult at times?
Yeah, it was a little difficult for me, and I was trying to get a hold of my fear of lots of people trying to see me, because it always happens me all the time. Sometimes I only have a little stage fright in my heart.
Well, you wouldn't be alone. I've got stage fright even talking with you, because you're an actress. And I guess, what are some of the challenges that you knew that may be difficult for you? And can you think of any example that helped you overcome it, maybe through playing a character or a role play?
Sometimes I always have to learn my lines for my play. Sometimes if I don't know one, I just have to say, Dr. Fly or whoever, I need to learn my lines.
So really, it was work. It wasn't just all play.
Yes.
And did you have a character that you really liked and that you really wanted to play?
Uh-huh. My character was Chameleon, or Camo for short, because chameleons change color in the African savanna and in the rainforest.
Wow. Well, I know we're going to take a short break, but I think when we come back, you maybe can tell us a little bit, put on the show mode, so to speak, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to do that. Would you be willing to do something like that?
Sure, I will do that.
Well, we were really excited. Let's just hold on 1 second. All of our listeners, don't go far. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Blythe Corbett and Shakaya Webster about the Sense Theater Program for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Adam Goldstein and myself, Laurel Sisler. We have been talking with Dr. Blythe Corbett and Shakaya Webster. Now, Shakaya, before the break, you were going to introduce us to the show that you put on called Makeover. I was hoping you could give us a taste of what that was like.
I think I have a song called Why Not. It was made by someone named Tammy Bice and Dr. Blythe, my specialty. It was the song that I played and learned. It was about a girl who was trying to change.
Well, we'd love to hear you sing it.
Yeah, why don't you at least sing the chorus?
Why not take a chance? Live your life, have a dance. Why not? It's nothing to lose. Accept yourself, it's easy to choose. There's no way you're going. There's no excuse. Why not?
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. That is so amazing.
Thanks.
What a powerful message there to just why not and take a chance and do things that are sometimes scary, like dancing and singing on the radio, and I can tell it's having an impact.
Were you dancing a little bit when you were performing that in the theater?
No, we were sitting down.
She's an amazing dancer, though, too, I must say.
Well, and I wonder what it has been like for you, Shakaya, to have now done this sort of program. And then we'll certainly, Dr. Corbett, want to know from you about what are the sort of things that you are wanting to see and are measuring in your research. But Shakaya, what was it like for you?
It was like if I'm just trying to be active and trying to be in a performance and try to be entertaining, and I'll be like, I'm really sure if I'm fine with Dr. Bly, the partner with up with my mom to see if I get some help and try to do the sense theater.
That's amazing. Did you feel it gave you some confidence after you were able to do it?
Yeah, it gave me some confidence.
Yeah, I bet.
I can tell just in the way you're talking about it.
Yeah, you seem like a very mature, poised fourth grader. We have to remember, you're just in fourth grade. That's amazing. I know everyone's proud. I know your mom is really proud in the community, and I'm sure Dr. Corbett. Dr. Corbett, what are the outcomes that you are really trying to, because you just got a large grant. That's alone amazing. The National Institute of Mental Health, these are NIH. The funding level for our listeners is usually less than 10%. That means 9 out of 10 people who apply don't get them. And here you've gotten a large research grant. What's the outcomes that you're really wanting to see?
Thank you so much. Yeah, this is a very large multi-site grant. And we're going to extend the research that we've already published in peer-reviewed journals and try to see if we can replicate some of the findings we've had here at Vanderbilt at other sites to include Stony Brook and University of Alabama. And the reason that this is so important is while we've had great success here at Vanderbilt, we want to make sure that other people might be able to transport and implement sense theater at other sites. And so what our previous research has shown is that we find significant gains in reciprocal social communication for our participants and other peers, including peers they haven't met before. We've shown significant improvement in social cognition, specifically in identifying and remembering faces, which is something that some of our children have a really difficult time with. We're also showing changes in terms of social communication in kind of everyday life, so how they interact at home and also in the community. And this is based on neuropsychological measures, as well as imaging, as well as parent and teacher report measures.
Let me ask a question. This is really amazing. You know, we sometimes will have this doctor talk and these outcomes, but I'm curious. I know one of the tools that I heard you use, Dr. Corbett, was improvisation. And I want to ask Shakaya, how did you learn improvisation? That seems to me like, first off, there's so many syllables in that word, it's got to be an adult word. How did you learn that, and what did you think about it?
I was thinking about it. It was like trying to get me a lot of stress and trying to figure out what really happens all the time.
And how does that work, Dr. Corbett? How do you teach these youth to use improvisation skills? What's that like for you?
Yeah, so we use a variety of theater games. And what this does is help us to realize that we can think differently about a situation. There's not just one way to respond or just one outcome. And so we do a lot through play. And that's where the peers are really pivotal, because they will get really silly and they'll come up with really kind of crazy ideas. And it gives the rest of us, you know, permission to be able to then think more broadly about how we might respond in a given circumstance. And, you know, a lot of our kids on the autism spectrum, they tend to think a little bit more concretely and have kind of narrow interests. And so engaging in some of these theater games and responding in ways that we might not usually respond helps us to start thinking a little bit differently in given circumstances, and also to not take ourselves quite as seriously and kind of have fun with it.
This just makes such good sense. It's nice to see that you're tracking outcomes too, to ensure that we really are doing something that's helpful, and it really on both fronts seems like it is. What do you think would need to happen to make this more accessible?
Well, I think one thing is that we need to change our definition of what we think of as treatment. So here we have shown in our work and others that one of the pivotal ingredients in our program is the impact of peers. These are typically developing children that are an extraordinary untapped resource in our school environments, that many of our kids genuinely want to help kids that maybe have some challenges, whether that be in a social area or something else. And they can be incredible role models for our kids under the right circumstances and through supervision. And so I think that's kind of a bigger message. The other is not just thinking about art as something that we appreciate or whatever, but it too can be a form of intervention. In this case, it happens to be the theater. So I think that's kind of a broader goal that we have in the program, and that we can utilize some things that we have currently in most schools, and that's a theater program. And it might be an important vehicle to helping not just children with autism, but children in general to continue to find their voice and different ways of expressing themselves in a safe environment.
And Shakaya, as we think about your acting start with this theater, do you have other things, other roles, other sorts of plays that you might like to play or be involved in dance and theater in the future, either in fifth grade or middle school?
Yes, somehow I was in the Nutcracker from the National Ballet last year, and it was kind of great. I was in six shows, and I was doing good. Sometimes I do practice in ballet, but now in February, I'm going to take ballet classes.
Wow.
Wow, that's pretty bold and brave. Do you mind me saying that?
Nah.
Yeah, it's bold. That's bold and brave for those of us who can't sing and never been on stage. So I think on behalf of our listeners across the country, we want to say thank you, Shakaya, for what you've done to bring your talents to such a much larger audience.
Oh, thanks.
It's really inspiring.
And we want to thank you, Dr. Corbett, for the vision to be out there and put this out there, let your peers judge it, who judged it worthy of funding. And we really, really look forward to the outcomes and maybe hosting a troupe here one day for a performance.
We would love that. And thank you so much for taking interest in our program and to allow us to be part of your show. We're so grateful.
We've been talking with Dr. Blythe Corbett, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Vanderbilt University and Director of the Sense Theater Program for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders, and with Shekiah Webster, a remarkable young performing actress who is a graduate of that program. Thank you so much for being with Your Health Today, both of you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laurel and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns. And Laurel, if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first health call question today about fluoride toothpaste.
So our first listener asks, I'm curious what you think about the use of fluoride in toothpaste. Many natural brands advertise as being fluoride-free, but I thought it was key in the prevention of cavities.
You know, this is really interesting, and I know that people probably have a lot of opinions because you can certainly have too little fluoride, and that is strongly associated with cavities, and you can have too much fluoride, and that can cause kind of spots on the teeth or called fluorosis, or too much fluoride that gets absorbed into the bones.
Right. Yeah, we were just talking about this before. I feel justified somewhat in my blaming of my mother for white spots on my teeth because she gave us extra fluoride. She didn't think there was enough.
Our parents, you know, they can't win, I don't think, but we love them and we don't blame them. And the question is, you know, we do know that we used to have four decades ago, 75% of children came through with multiple caries, multiple
erosions of the tooth and rotting teeth
and, you know, getting to see the dentist and you solve mouthfuls of mercury at one point in time. Now we don't give mercury-based fillings. And so we know that that could be a real problem and we reduced it. And so the question really is at what age and what are the alternatives? And I know that today when you have children and you take them in to see your primary care physician or the dentist, you may encounter strong opinions. And what I would really say for our listeners is ask your primary care physician, ask your dentist, what is the data? And so for young children, they should have a very small amount, less than a pea size amount when you use fluoride on toothpaste and under supervision twice a day, because you can get the benefit but not the harm. The other alternative is these varnishes that your primary care provider and dentist can place on the teeth that can reduce the likelihood of these cavities. I think either one is acceptable, and it's better than having a mouthful of cavities, which is not really good and bad for the children's health. What's our next house call, Laura?
After noticing a painful knot on the joint of one toe, I made an appointment with my physician. On the day of my appointment, the knot was gone. My doctor suggested it could be bursitis. What is that, and am I likely to see more of these painful knots?
You know, knots that go away are better than knots that stay. I mean, that, you know, you don't pay me for that advice, but that is true. I don't know if you've ever had things on your body, Laurel, that, you know, you make an appointment with the doctor and it kind of is gone by the time you get there. You had
kind
a cough,
like
it's gone.
Kind of like taking the car into the shop. The sound was there and then it's gone.
That's right, but you know that there was still a problem.
Right.
In this particular case, you know, when I first heard this about painful knot on the joint of one toe, I thought, oh, gout. You know, and gout could certainly go away. Maybe you took ibuprofen or Aleve, Naprosyn, something that was an anti-inflammatory and that made it go away. On the other hand, it could have been an inflammation from rubbing your toe with a shoe. You know, 95% of foot problems are shoe problems, and maybe that was the problem. Or maybe it was, we call it these ganglion cysts, those old Bible cysts that when, you know, they took the Bible and they smashed them and it kind of oozed out and so forth. Yeah, it kind of sounds worse than it is, but
yeah,
it seemed to work. And though we don't recommend it today. And so it's hard to say. But it was painful, so that would indicate there was some sort of inflammation or irritation. What would you want your doctor to tell you?
I'd be happy it was gone. And if it came back, I would try to go in and get it seen while the symptoms were there.
And I would ideally say, can you take a picture and send me the picture
that's
early
a good idea
on?
Yeah. Yep.
So we can get a sense of what it actually looks like.
Yeah.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
I'm a 48-year-old man, and my entire life I've been prone to eating unhealthily when stressed. I'd really like to break this habit. Do you have any advice?
We want you to be healthy. What would you advise, Laura?
Right.
Who runs the weight management program for the University of North Carolina's Family Medicine Center?
Yeah, I think that the key word to me there is stress. It sounds like that's the root cause of the situation. So it would depend on if the caller was willing to talk about stress or willing to do things to reduce stress. Things like even just 5 minutes of deep breathing or mindfulness can significantly reduce stress levels. So I might see about their willingness to try one of those strategies. If you wanted to really just tackle it from the eating perspective, getting on a really good schedule of eating so you're not going too long in between meals. Ideally, they're very healthy meals. That can really help. Often people will overeat a lot in the evenings because they actually haven't eaten enough during the day. And so by getting on a really good schedule, that can prevent supposed stress eating in the evenings. Really, maybe it's that you're actually just hungry. So that is my two cents.
I know some of my guy friends who are about this age, Jimmy, a few years older, have told me that they really stick to schedules. They have pretty much the same thing for breakfast, the same thing for lunch, maybe a couple, two or three things. And they eat the same time and about the same amount. So it's kind of a very fixed way of approaching. So I assume when they're stressed, they still eat the same way. Now, they don't struggle with weight gain and obesity. We don't know if this particular man is obese, but certainly there's this element here of eating, as he said, unhealthily.
Yeah.
And we want to promote really good eating. So I think stress reduction, and really working with someone, maybe some yoga, maybe some meditation.
Some counseling,
mm-hmm. physical activity, things that could help reduce. Great advice. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I live 8 hours away from my 89-year-old mother. Recently, I've gotten the sense that she's lonelier than she's been in the past. Do you have any suggestions of things I might do to alleviate that? Is there anything medically that could be causing an increase in loneliness, and or are there any complications to general health that might result from increased loneliness in an elderly woman?
Well, I think what's causing it is that you've chosen not to live there. You need to go move 8 hours and live with your mother. I mean, that's
you're
what she would say.
It. You're hitting right on the point that they don't want to think about.
Yeah,
there's some guilt in this question.
Maybe the mother's
in.
Perspective here, this is a difficult situation. And an important question that really we've done some work here on the show. We've had some guests on the show talk about loneliness as kind of a modern epidemic. And we know that that's a significant problem.
Yeah, it's a problem, and it's common, particularly in people as they get to be, in their 80s and their 90s. I was just at my grandfather's 90th birthday, and the amount of friends he had there still, two, three, four people, primarily relatives that are significantly younger than him that were there.
I think one of the things that can be done is to recognize that you are dealing with loneliness, and this may be loss, and it may be distance and other things, and help set up some technology. I know when my mother was moving and we were trying to get her connected with her children more, we worked on using technology and setting up one of the iPads and a computer and the iPhone and even getting her a different phone that was not a flip phone that she could hear and listen and see and visually. And she would just look sometimes for a minute or two, maybe say a sentence and smile. And that alone was really helpful. Writing letters and connecting in a non-visual way. Lots of ways of creating some more community. I think these are all good things.
Yeah, and thinking about my grandfather as well, he planned his own birthday party. And so a purpose, whatever that is, whether it's planning a birthday party or, them caring for an animal or, there are many ideas there, but purpose can really help with loneliness, I believe.
Thank you so much for your question, and thank you to all of our listeners for thoughtful questions. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to our listeners' health, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. You can visit us online to find out more information at yourhealthradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Just search Your Health for our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Laurel Sisler, and our guests today, Dr. Blythe Corbett and Shekiah Webster. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Laurel Sisler.
Look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.